You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. Costa Rica's presidential election, the musical will write itself. My guests Carlota Rebello and Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the return of Roseanne, the strange reluctance of cabin crew dress codes to move with the times, and Ireland's bars and pubs enjoy their first Good Friday opening. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Carlota Rebello and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Welcome both. And we will start with Costa Rica, which is not a way we introduce programs every day of the week. But on Sunday, the people of that Central American country will vote in the decisive runoff of their presidential election. One contender is Fabricio Alvarado Munoz, a former television host. What could possibly go wrong? And the other is Carlos Alvarado Quesada. No relation. Possibly the key difference between the pair is their views on gay marriage, which Munoz opposes and Quesada favours. Fernando, first of all, I should preface this question with the observation I don't regard gay marriage as at all a trivial issue. It's clearly an extremely important civil rights concern and so on. But is it strange that it ends up becoming such a dominant theme in a presidential election, in which traditionally people usually vote on the obvious stuff like the economy?
I find it strange, but to be honest, in Latin America, I've been seeing this more and more. I do honestly think that before we didn't have this kind of social wars like you have in the United States. But now, including in my own country, Brazil, elections are being disputed in what's your views on abortion, on gay marriage, on religion. I think those things are sometimes more important to voters than what's your plan for the economy or for the budget, or crime is rising, what are you going to do with the violence? I think people are very much in tune with this kind of cultural wars, in a way, using the expression we use in the United States quite a lot.
But do you think these are, in Latin American elections, being framed as... I know what you mean, because when we had in my native Australia a referendum on gay marriage quite recently, that was very much a culture war kind of thing. But is it being seen like that in Latin America as a culture war, not rather as you would think it should be, a civil rights issue?
I think it's a culture war in the sense that before nobody used to discuss that, you know, but now actually, you know, gay rights, people, they're getting, we're getting a lot of rights actually in Latin America. A lot of countries in South America have approved gay marriage before some European countries. You have Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, Uruguay, most states in Mexico approving that. So I think when a group like this has so much kind of importance in society, there's always a backlash. And I think that's what we're seeing. And that's why it became a main topic in this election, because an international court based in San Jose in Costa Rica said that the country should legalize gay marriage. And that's why Fabricio Alvarado, the Christian candidate, you know, came so strong, because he said, well, you know what, I think that's wrong. And a lot of people agree with him, unfortunately.
Carlota, Munoz, who is against gay marriage, as opponents of gay marriage often do, is hammering the family values thing as if the two things are completely incompatible, or as if indeed they're not actually the same thing. I've never understood this, why people who claim to be in favour of family values are against the potential creation of more families. Who does this still fly with? How does this argument still work?
Well, he's obviously appealing to his own conservative and Christian base, I guess. And the thing is that the latest polls are so close that he has started as well to broaden up, to tout this idea that he would also try to create more jobs, etc. So going a bit further away from just the issue of same-sex marriage to see if he can attract some of the voters from Carlos Quesada, which I'm not sure if that will do it, just mentioning that you would create jobs. That just seems so obvious if you're running to be in charge of a country that you shouldn't be. Now I'm.
It would be quite novel to run saying I'm not going to create jobs.
Yeah, that would be the novelty. but what Fernando was referring earlier, it's so true. I think when it comes to same-sex marriage and these social values and discussions, it has become and taken such a more prominent role in elections these days, particularly in Central and Latin America. And I just think it's people voting, people do vote with emotion when this is a central point, rather than measuring both of the sides and who would actually work more in favor of your country.
Guys, we do have an unusual opportunity with this election to be able to judge the candidates in song and make a decision on that basis, because they both have had careers of varying degrees of distinguishedness, whatever the word I'm looking
You're
for there
two
is.
Foreigners.
I know. It's not that word, but it's a word a bit like it. But we do have clips from some of their musical output. This is Fabrizio Alvarado Munoz first. Okay, well, that was Fabrizio Alvarado Munoz. Carlotta, both Fernando and I started doing the throat-slashing gesture there quite early. You seem to be quite getting into that.
Look, I'm not getting into that, but when it comes to any songs with this sort of rhythm, so this Latin style, you know that the crescendo is just coming and you need to wait for it. So it's like, even if you don't like it, until the crescendo shows up.
That's the bit where he gets off his stool and walks towards the edge of the stage, isn't it?
Yes. And he starts walking around and everyone starts shouting. You could see it. And it's just like, you need to wait for it before you judge, guys. That's all I'm saying.
Let's give him credit. I mean, from the two of them, he's the most popular of them. He got more views on YouTube than the other one.
I can't wait to hear the next one,
then. That's not necessarily an endorsement. But yes, this is the centre-left candidate, Carlos Alvarado Quesada.
Well, I like to see that the gestures changed. Andrew just had a big old face palm.
No, it wasn't a face palm. That guitar sound really reminds me of somebody. There's something kind of late 80s indie rock about it, and I can't quite figure out.
So you would prefer this one?
I do. I mean, just so we're clear on this, I thought they were both absolutely dreadful, but I do mildly prefer the second of the two, as indeed I suspect, at the risk of tipping the balance, I think I mildly prefer that candidate.
Now, there's one thing about this whole election that I think is quite fascinating. That is that the vote, this second runoff, is happening on Easter Sunday. When you have one of the candidates, you know, when it's a poll that is so close, when you have one of the candidates that has a strong religious base and a conservative views that are becoming, you know, and are the main focus of his whole campaign, does the fact that the vote is happening over a really important religious holiday in Costa Rica, Easter Sunday, does that mean he has some sort of advantage? I don't know. I wonder, but it has made me question that if the date of the vote has immediately given some sort of edge.
And there's another point very quickly saying that, you know, the candidate, Carlos Alvarado, I mean, he got the votes in the more urban areas of Costa Rica, which are more affluent, and they tend to travel during Easter as well.
Exactly.
Bad for him.
So maybe most of the opponents won't even be in Costa Rica for the vote. We'll have to wait and see how many of the 3.3 million voters show up. But I just thought it was an interesting thing to assess for the result.
I think it's an REM song. It reminded me of something. So it's got that sound about something off Fables of the Reconstruction, their third album, I think, something around that period. Anyway, let us turn now to the United States, where an audience estimated at 18 million, that's six Costa Rican electorates, tuned in this week to welcome back a clear really much missed television family. The Connors, the clan whose matriarch gave the show its title, Roseanne. When Roseanne first aired from 1988 to 1997, it was seen as innovative, if not outright revolutionary, an honest, witty, and resolutely unpatronizing depiction of working-class white America. In 2018, for obvious reasons, this is arguably a more loaded proposition. And indeed, President Donald Trump found time in his busy schedule of golf and shouting at CNN to congratulate its creator, Roseanne Barr. Were any of you, either of you, indeed, fans the first time, or am I the only person at this table old enough to have remembered it?
I've seen one or two episodes, and you know, even though I was not the biggest fan, I understood her importance at the time for depicting such a family, and you know, she's very important to many Americans. But yes, I was not a fan
until this story came up. I had no idea who Roseanne was. I'll be straight
but just to follow that up, Carlotta, that though you may not have heard of Roseanne, you will be familiar with the argument, as anybody who has listened to, consumed, read the news in the last however long will be, with this idea that the white working class America has been left behind and forgotten and neglected.
Yes.
Do you think that's true? Because it strikes me that we spend an awful lot of time talking about them.
Well, I wouldn't say forgotten and neglected, perhaps trying very hard to put myself in their shoes, that their views are not reflected in the same way. With that I mean, for example, most of Hollywood tends to be liberal, tends to be somewhat left-leaning, democratic, even though, of course, you have very well-known Republicans as actors and directors, but you can name them, whereas the vast majority of everyone else, that's not the case. That immediately means that the people sitting in the boardrooms, in the writers' rooms, in the production areas, would most likely fall onto the same category as well. So now, is it the right thing when to portray views that might not be the correct ones from your point of view? And when you look at the type of shows that the Republican versus Democrat viewership watch, the Republican ones tend to be a lot of like home improvement, you can make like DIY type of stuff, which is, I don't know what it says about it, but in terms of like, or reality TV, whereas those dramas that are very well crafted, that you know are on Netflix, for example, are most always watched by a Democratic base. I don't know, I was thinking back to a couple of years ago, I don't remember when exactly, when Fox News was trying to bridge that gap in U.S. late night television, because obviously all SNL and The Late Show and all of that, it's liberal. It's a completely different viewership, and is most likely, and most of the times, making fun of Republicans and everything that happens that is going wrong with some of the Republican views. And Fox News was trying to bridge that gap and present the same format of, you know, a comedy, late-night television show. And they had one, the half-hour news program, but that only lasted one season. It ended up being a huge flop for Fox News, even though when it was created, it's like, there's no other. So you would assume all its conservative viewership would tune in to that program.
The problem with that, though, was that it was terrible and not funny.
Well, yes, but because that's what you find funny is the things that probably the people watching this would probably be proud of.
You don't have to agree with something amused by it.
No, of course not. But it's like, it was rated as one of the worst rated shows that Fox News ever produced.
If I may defend Roseanne, one thing that she said, I kind of agree. I'm not saying that I'm a fan, you know, she's a Trump supporter and everything, but there's a problem, especially with the left and even with Hollywood, to never hear like a different opinion. And she wants to portray that in the show. She mentioned that she wants to agree to disagree in a way, because of course we're saying that she's a Trump supporter, but I've seen some clips of the new season and there's a discussion there. You know, she's a Trump supporter in the series, but you know, I think her daughter is like a Hillary voter. So there's a discussion there. There's some disagreement, which is something that you don't see, because I do honestly think that the left can be also quite arrogant.
Of course.
In some ways. And I actually thought it was quite a charming episode from what I can see. But, you know, I'm not an expert on Roseanne.
I thought it was quite funny the first time. Would watch the rerun.
Yeah. Maybe I'll watch it with you, Andrew, for the first time for me.
But I do want to just discuss, before we take a short break, I mean, it's an obvious thing, but Donald Trump referring to this reboot of Roseanne at a recent rally in Ohio, sort of God, this is going to be a long evening. Enthusing about it. Enthusiating. What the heck is that?
I don't know.
What the heck is enthusiating? It does sound, word. It sounds like a word Trump would use. Anyway, he was enthusiating about Roseanne at this rally in Ohio, and he said it was a program, as he put it, about us reaching out to his audience. This is a man who is doing he is working for the first time in a job which is not for a company named after him.
No.
How has he got away with selling himself as a sentinel of the common working schlub?
Andrew, unfortunately, I do not have the answer for that, but it is a discussion we've had on this table so many times and during this campaign in the run-up to the election. How are people, working-class Americans, saying, he's one of us, a guy who's a millionaire, inherited so much money, you know, barely had to work through his life, and it feeds back into us. But going back to the question about catering in terms of entertainment shows to right-wing media, I don't know if you remember last year this movie called Beatrice at Dinner, which when it came out was described as the first film of the Trump era. Basically had Salma Hayek portraying a Mexican immigrant in the United States. She's a massage therapist, and she's at a house of a very rich client. And her car breaks down. She's invited to dinner. And the dinner is a Mexican immigrant, Salma Hayek, with Salma Hayek's character, with all these billionaires around her. And it ends up having that question, oh, where are you from? And she says, Pasadena. It's like, no, where are you really from? And then it's just the whole movie is highlighting this rich and poor or less privileged divide in the U.S. But because the production was, you know, a typical Hollywood production, it would be probably what we would agree, rather than if you were one of those billionaires watching, you wouldn't identify with it at all. I don't know. I just think it's an issue that there should be options for everyone. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Carlotta Ribello and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. More shortly.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Carlotta Ribello and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Now, it is obviously good news that negotiations between Cathay Pacific and its cabin crew union have ended in agreement that female flight crew can, from here on, wear trousers rather than skirts if they prefer. It is arguably somewhat weird, however, that this remains a topic of debate at this reasonably advanced point in the human experiment. Carlotta, is there an... I'm trying really hard here to imagine in my head how all this discussion would have gone, like, if the cruise union came in and said the women want to wear trousers if they prefer rather than skirts. I'm trying to understand what the negative response to that could have been.
Yeah, I was struggling when I saw the story to understand why it took so long for the decision to come out, because obviously they approached them and they've been in negotiations. I think it'd be a case...
This is what
okay,
I was wondering.
We'll find a designer that can make trousers in the same style and okay, that's fine. I don't know. I do not understand the fascination. And obviously airlines is a completely different industry, has always been known for, you know, the outfits, and some of them do sexualize female outfits quite a lot. Not as much now, but tend to when it began, when the first airlines were coming up. But I do not for the life of me understand why it should matter if you wear trousers, skirts, high heels, or flat shoes.
We should note that the change would take about 3 years as well until they make new uniforms. So we're talking about the story, but actually I was reading. So probably they can only actually wear trousers in 3 years' time. So we'll still have some time
It is really weird. It's as you were saying, Carlotta, I can't imagine what the response could be other than, all right, that sounds reasonable.
And I can understand, I can even give in from the airline's perspective, whichever airline it is, to say, okay, well, it's not going to be all trousers, but you have both options. If today you don't feel like wearing a skirt, you just don't. And also, when you think about health and safety reasons, that security card they make you read, or they indicate we should read every flight we take, but I don't think any of us has ever done that. One of the things it says...
I don't know. I've been on a couple of planes where I've paid real close attention.
One of the things it says is that if you have to land on water and inflatable slide on the over the wings exit comes on, you have to take your high heels off. All the air stewardess have to do that. Skirts, they can't be practical in an emergency situation. It's just like, in terms of health and safety, I do not understand it for the life of me.
And that's the thing, because I don't mind companies having a uniform. I actually
It's reasonable for cabin crews.
It's very reasonable. But as Carlotta was saying, I mean, to wear skirts, actually, it's harder for them to do their job. Yeah. I think wearing trousers in that case, again, if they want to wear skirts, please, But, I think in that type of job, I think it makes perfect sense. But of course, I think uniforms are still a good idea.
Is it possible, though, that airlines might be overthinking this aspect of their presentation? It may just be me, but I was thinking back to the last bunch of flights I took and trying to picture in my head if I could describe what the air crew were wearing, and I've got absolutely nothing.
Well, I think it's quite important, how they look like, it's the color, the fit, because nobody wants to see somebody wearing, very loose uniform, being either a man or a woman in a way. So I'm not sure if I would like to fly again with an airline with a bad uniform.
I'm 100%.
What was the last bad uniform you can remember seeing?
Well, I had a few with a low-budget Spanish airline, which I don't want to mention the name, but I just didn't like the uniforms, and they had other bad things as well. It was not only the uniform.
Very diplomatic, Fernando, there.
Yes.
I was going to say, yes, I'm 100% behind the uniform. I think it brings this brand unity that it's necessary in airlines. You want to look at certain colors and be like, that's Alitalia, that's KLM, that's British Airways. It's part of recognizing, when the plane is coming up the tarmac, you can immediately buy the colors, even if you don't see the logo, tell which airline it is. And the uniform plays to that fantasy as well. Now, in terms of design, whether it's a skirt or trousers, I don't think that will matter. And having the option for both, I remember Air India, for example, the air stewardess used to use traditional sari, and they just simply added the option of having, how they call it, more Western uniforms, which long trousers with a yellow blouse. But if you, as your personal preference, were still to wear the traditional sari style uniform, you could do that. And I think just give people the choice. That's the best approach.
A factoid I did wish to insert into the conversation, something I found during my meticulous research for this spot, was that it wasn't until last year, 2017, that the first airline ran a completely female-staffed flight. That's pilots, crew, all check-in, all luggage dispatch. And it was Ethiopian Airlines.
Yeah, I was very surprised when I heard about that.
I would have assumed, obviously, ignorantly, that this is something that just would have happened much earlier.
But they've done that on purpose. They wanted to make a point.
They did it on purpose to make a statement, but nonetheless, it still took until last year for that to happen.
Yeah, and all the technicians as well, in terms of refueling and everything, so the ground force crew as well, I think was mostly female too. It wasn't just
Everybody
flight.
Was. Yes. The whole flight from go to
which is astonishing. But, for example, KLM, since 2010, that they do have a version of their uniform that is basically a pantsuit. And the air stewardess can decide whatever they want to wear at whichever occasion. And also, if you think, maybe if you're doing a lot of flights during the day, you might want to change clothes and into something more comfortable. I just don't understand why in 2018 this is still an issue and it still makes headlines. It should just be, you should have changed this a long time ago.
Okay, well, finally tonight, I have flown with Ethiopian Airlines, by the way. They were really good. The food's fantastic.
Good to know.
Free plug there for Ethiopian Airlines. But finally tonight, and persisting with the theme of the rescinding of arcane regulations, listeners in the Republic of Ireland will this evening be able to, for the first time ever, go out for a drink on Good Friday, if indeed they haven't started already. The law forbidding such licentiousness was repealed in January. I do have a story illuminating what it used to be like. I was in the Republic of Ireland many years ago, spending Easter with the family of my then girlfriend. On Good Friday, some people were flying into Galway, which is where she lived, from Dublin. We drove out to the airport to meet them. On arriving at the airport, we could find nowhere to park the car. We couldn't understand why the airport was absolutely packed. It was Good Friday. There was only one more plane coming in, and it was a little puddle jumper from Dublin. And we just thought, what is going on? Is the Pope coming to town? I mean, it was absolutely heaving. And then we walked into the airport and realized, oh yeah, airports are allowed serve on Good Friday. So everybody just driven from miles around to the one place in the entire county you could get a drink.
Well, it does make sense if that's what you want. I think it would make sense for the Irish.
is this a good thing?
I think so, you know, freedom to the pubs. I mean, because, you know, if you're religious and if you believe that you shouldn't drink, just don't do it, but allow others to do it. I think it's about time, in a way. But, you know, I'm not saying that people should consume alcohol in the amount they do, but I think it's much better to sell alcohol than to forbid. I hate any sort of restriction.
And also it would be good for tourism as well, you know, it would be good. I don't know, I can assume that there must be a high percentage of tourists that happened to be in Ireland and didn't know about
I have been that tourist.
About the old ban, and then you just you know, you want to go for a drink and you can't.
It's like in Brazil, my home country, doing an election day, you're forbidden to buy alcohol. Actually, if somebody spot you buying, you can go to jail, actually.
You can't buy a drink on election day.
No. Imagine if you're a tourist, an Australian tourist in Brazil.
It's usually one of the days you most want a drink.
Yeah, exactly.
Depending on the result.
Oh, look at our candidates. You do need a drink. A strong one.
But you can drink it. So if you have it, you can drink it.
Well, if you have it at home, yes. But you can't buy it in bars or any restaurants or any...
And supermarkets? You can't either?
I don't think so as well.
Do either of you have experience of having to go to extreme lengths to source a drink due to local peculiarities?
Yeah, so a couple of years ago I was in Tennessee and I didn't know about that very archaic law that still comes from prohibition times, that some of the southern states on Sunday the liquor stores can't sell you alcohol, particularly beer, wine, and obviously bars can sell anything.
There are some counties which are dry all the time, yeah, including famously Lynchburg, home of Jack Daniels.
Exactly, which is, you know, the joke writes itself. But I was with some friends, we were in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and we didn't know about that. And we were just like, you know, we're on holiday, so Sunday could be a Friday. So we're just trying to find a place where we could buy alcohol and everything was closed. And that's when someone told us, oh, you look foreign, let me tell you what's up and explain what was going on. So we just drove over to Georgia to buy, to stack up. A 2-hour car drive, which wasn't too bad, you know, when it comes to the United States and alliance. It could have been worse because other than Georgia, everything else surrounding Tennessee has the same prohibition.
I've been to countries which are Islamic countries mostly, which have been either actually or partly alcohol-free, at least officially. I have done the thing in a hotel bar in Pakistan of solemnly filling out and signing the form, declaring and vouchsafing that you are not a Muslim and can therefore be poured a beer.
Well, and may I say, I have this problem almost every Friday evening as well in London, because they stop selling alcohol in shops like at 11. One day I was drinking, well, I know it sounds wrong, but I was drinking champagne with two friends at home and we wanted to buy more alcohol, but everywhere was closed. So I had to go to a restaurant and they only had English sparkling wine, which is not as good as champagne. And yeah, it was traumatizing.
Get used to it, Fernando. After Brexit, that's how they're going to be celebrating. But you know, in London, it's so true, especially supermarkets.
It's hard.
After 10 p.m., you can't buy alcohol.
Even good champagne, you know, it's just...
I know. Well, on that heart-rending tale of woe, Fernando, which I think has brought the suffering which Good Friday commemorates into a certain degree of perspective, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Carlotta Ribello and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you for joining us. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You can tell everyone's on holiday, can't you? And Tom Melville, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. Music next at 1900, it's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great Easter weekend. Thanks for listening.